Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. Our topic today?
Words.
Power of words, of language.
Yep.
Okay, so Nicaragua, 1970s. That's where our next story starts. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
So imagine you're a kid that's deaf in Nicaragua at this time.
Born deaf or?
Born deaf. Okay. You've always been deaf and you're the only one in your family that's deaf. Mm. So you're in this situation where everybody's talking, their mouths are moving, you can't hear it, and you don't know sign language because no one's taught you.
There was no deaf school in Nicaragua then?
Nothing.
Okay.
No deaf education of any kind. So if you were this kid, all you've really got are a couple of gestures, really crude gestures you've worked out to talk to your family and friends. But beyond that, you're cut off. Like Ildefonso, the guy we met at the beginning of this show, except in Nicaragua in the 70s, there were hundreds, maybe thousands of these Ildefonsos.
Really?
Yeah. But then everything changes.
In the late 70s, Hope Somoza, who was the wife of the then dictator, established a new school for special education. I think she had someone in her family who had a disability, not deafness.
But the school would include deaf people, and that, says psychology professor Ann Senghas, was a first. Because now, instead of deaf kids scattered about, they were together in the same room.
There were 50 deaf kids in that first entering class.
Preschool to sixth grade.
In the late 70s.
And for most of them, this was the first time they'd ever met another deaf person.
Before, the world was going on around them and everyone was all talking and they were cut off from that. And suddenly, for the first time, they were all there and they were what was happening and they were what there was to talk about.
But they didn't have a way of talking. These were 50 different kids who'd never learned a language and had 50 different sets of like rudimentary gestures that they used to.
Well, that must have been.
Yeah, like 50 people with 50 different ways to try and
ask for breakfast
or say they want to go outside. I mean, nothing was shared.
It's not like the teachers were using sign in the classroom. Everything in the classroom was Spanish,
which none of them knew.
Copying it into their notebooks. A lot of it was going right over their heads.
So at the beginning, things were completely confusing.
But they're riding on the bus for an hour every day, and they're playing out of recess for an hour every day, and they're getting together at the park. And
no one knows how it happened. Like maybe one of the kids who was
very charismatic,
he invented a sign for, say, ball, then told it to another kid who was
very, you know, socially active.
And that second kid then spread the sign, however it worked. Over time, the signs that these 50 kids used
started to converge into a common system.
And when you step back from it all, what that means?
They created a language. They didn't just take it from somewhere else. They couldn't take it from somewhere else. They created their own.
But how unusual is that?
Like, this has happened with languages all over the world, but not while people were watching.
And so you're saying this is the first time we've been able to watch a language being born?
Yeah.
Wow. And for the last 20 years, that is what Anne has been doing. She's been going to Nicaragua to that school and watching.
So, you wanted to describe the. So I may have gotten a recording of this, but when you arrive at the school, the buses come around, the kids are all screaming and leaning out the windows and signing to each other. And the kids pile out and they line up in rows on the basketball court that's in the center of the schoolyard. And they all sing the national hymn. And the deaf kids all sign the national hymn. They all have one hand over their heart and sign with the other hand, while the hearing kids sing it. And
Anne visited the school for the first time in 1990, about 10 years after it was formed. She'd been working at the time with a linguist
named Judy Kegel.
studying basic linguist type stuff.
Right, trying to figure out how the verbs work and whether they have agreement with their grammatical objects.
And along the way, her and a collaborator, Jetty Pyers, stumbled into something really surprising about the power of certain words. So to set it up, when she got there the first time to Nicaragua, those original 50 kids who'd invented this thing had grown up already, and there were these younger generations of kids coming in behind them, growing up with the language, using it, inventing new signs. And at a certain point, she got curious to just compare the original signers, the older kids, to the younger kids.
Yeah.
In terms of how they sign.
So we show everyone this little one-minute cartoon about this guy who's trying to fly. He sees a bird flying, and he puts all these feathers on his body and climbs up to the top of a mountain, flaps his arm, and jumps and crashes on the ground.
So she showed deaf kids of different generations this cartoon and asked them pretty simply to describe
what they saw.
Just describe it and sign.
Describe the whole story.
The differences were striking.
So,
first of all.
So I'll just show you an example of each.
So you're opening up a movie here.
So this is a first cohort signer talking about.
She got out her laptop and showed me some video. First of this woman in her 40s with dark hair and a colorful t-shirt. She was one of the original signers. And when you see older signers like her describe this guy who's trying to fly, it's really spastic. It's almost like they become the cartoon. And she's flapping her hands.
She's so
moving all around.
A lot of full body movements. She's talking about someone who's moving in a crazy way. She's going to be moving in a crazy way. And
then she showed me a young kid who was about 8 with a backwards cap.
So here's Sylvester, and now he talks about the manner.
When he described the man jumping and then falling, it was all in the wrist.
All the movement is now in the hand, and it's very
stylish.
You know, they're trimming these signs down.
But more to the point, there was one thing she noticed that was really unexpected, had nothing to do with movement.
Couldn't help noticing that different people in the community talked about different things in this story. The older signers tended to describe all the events in this story.
And only the events.
And the younger kids,
they would talk about the guy's feelings.
That this guy was trying to fly, wanted to fly, but failed.
The kids, she says, just seemed to be better at
thinking about
thinking. Like other people's thinking. So Anne and Jenny decided, let's take all the different generations of deaf kids.
40-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 10-year-olds.
Let me test them on how well they can think about thinking. So what they did was they showed everybody a comic strip, different from before. This one was about two brothers.
There's a big brother who's playing with the train, and then little brother is like wanting to play with the train, and the big brother's playing with the train. And then the big brother puts it under the bed and goes into the kitchen to eat a sandwich.
And maybe before he goes, he looks at the little brother and says, hey, don't touch my train. Don't touch it.
And then little brother, while the big brother's out of the room, takes the train out and hides it in the toy box. And then the big brother comes back, and the question is, where's the big brother going to go to find his train? Is he going to look under the bed, or is he going to look in the toy box?
Well, he's going to look under the bed.
Yep.
Because as far as he knows, that's where he left it.
Yeah.
He didn't see it move.
And if you ask kids over the age of 5, most of them would say he's going to look under the bed because that's where he left it, and he doesn't know that it's been moved to the toy box. But here's the thing. When she asked the older signers,
they would say, oh, he'll look in the toy box.
Really?
They would pick the wrong one. These are 35-year-olds.
35-year-olds would get this wrong?
They would fail this task, yeah.
7 out of 8, she says.
And then all of the younger signers that we worked with passed.
At this point, she's just confused. Like, why would this be? Why can't the older people pass this simple test? You know, that involves thinking about someone else's thinking. What's going on here? And then it occurred to her, it might have something to do with certain words, because the older signers, they don't really have that many words for the concept of
thinking.
I mean, they have mainly just one sign, pointing at your forehead.
Yeah.
Basically, you just point at your forehead with your index finger. But by the time you get to the younger kids, they've got tons of words for thinking.
Things like, I know something and I know that you don't know it.
I know something and so I know you do know it. They've got a sign for understand, believe,
remember, forget.
How many roughly were there?
10 or 12.
Wow. So from 30 years, we go from just a couple to...
Well, we went from like knowing and not knowing, right?
To 12?
Yeah.
And somehow that makes all the difference, she says. The more of these think words you've got, the more you can think. Am I right to say that? You're tiptoeing toward that, but maybe you don't want to go there all the way?
Yeah, I'm trying to think that... I guess I don't think it's so simple that you could just go in and say, hey, I'm going to teach you 10 signs today, and now suddenly you're going to have better cognitive capacity.
But you are saying, though, that the verb think is somehow implicated in my ability to think about your thinking.
Right. Thinking about thinking. Understanding how other people understand. That's something that having language makes you better at.
There are certain words, she says, that don't just give you a name for something. Somehow, they give you access to a concept that would otherwise be really hard to get. Or even talk about. It's really hard to talk about thoughts without the word thoughts. Or what is time without the word time? It's a really freaking hard concept. These words are like bridges. Somehow they get you to some new mental place that otherwise you'd be cut off from. But that's sad, though. I mean, these young kids have something that the people who actually invented the language don't.
But we went back 2 years later, tested the same people, and then suddenly some of them were performing a lot better than they had the 2 years before on the same kinds of tasks.
You mean the older signers?
Yeah.
They were passing suddenly?
Some of them were passing, yeah.
What happened?
What happened in the past 2 years?
Yeah.
Those younger kids grew up and started hanging out at the Deaf Association.
Wait, what?
So what had happened in the meantime...
So here's the strange twist of the whole thing. The Deaf Association is this place where the older signers would hang out.
Yeah, it's a social club.
So they'd play chess, do whatever. Well, at a certain point, these youngsters start showing up, you know, because they've graduated and they want to hang out at the Deaf Association too. But they bring with them all of their new...
mental verbs.
You know, all these words for thinking. They start using it with the older kids. The older kids pick it up. Suddenly, these older kids are now passing the test.
So there was learning that took place in adulthood that actually gives them new insight into other people's thinking and motivation, and now they could pass these tasks.
That's super
interesting. So that's the story. It's really cool.
Ann Senghas is an associate professor of psychology at Barnard College in New York.
The thing, of course, you wonder is once you've gotten this new facility in you, like there's a lot of literature about this. My Fair Lady is about this.
My Fair Lady is about this?
Yeah, it's about a woman who learns proper English and she can no longer be a flower girl in Covent Garden. She's now a lady.
Yeah, I guess it is kind of like this.
Remember our program began with the story of Ildefonso.
Right, which we heard from Susan Schaller. Ildefonso was the guy who for 27 years had no language at all.
So you kind of wonder.
I mean, I can tell you that.
Like, what happened to Ildefonso once he got language?
Right. And after that first breakthrough where Ildefonso realized things have names, Susan ended up leaving for a few years.
Let's see. It was about 4 years, I think. 4 or 5.
But then she decided to write a book about him.
And so I went and found him again. And he had language, and I could ask him all kinds of questions.
Were you able then to sit down with him and ask him about his life and to really get the sort of his biography?
Somewhat. One area that everyone wants to know about is what was it like to be languageless? You know, what was going on in his head?
Yeah.
And I asked and I asked and I asked, and he starts telling me that was the dark time in his life. Learning language, it's like the lights went on. And I tell him, well, we know about language, and we want to know what it's like not to have language. And he doesn't want to talk about it.
But there was a day, she says, when she was writing the book, and she met Ildefonso in a restaurant. And there he was, sitting with his brother Mario, who she'd never met before. And she quickly learned that Mario also was deaf.
And languageless.
Really?
So I was shocked, and because I was so amazed, going, I can't believe you have a languageless brother. That's when Ildefonso said, well, let me introduce you to some of my friends.
So they get in a car and they drive for a while.
We stop at this apartment. We walk into this small little room. and there were these six Mexican men doing this mime routine.
Wait, all these guys were like Ildefonso used to be?
They had no language.
Wow.
They were all born deaf, and they didn't know that they were deaf.
And what were they doing?
One man would stand up, and he would start miming. He would just start acting out a bullfight. So he'd be the bull, and he'd be charging, and then he'd be the matador, and then he'd be somebody in the crowd watching, and then he would add a detail.
For example?
A hat.
And they'd swap, so then another guy would get up to take over the story.
Then they'd start miming.
They'd reenact the matador.
Describe the hat.
But now the second storyteller would add a new detail.
Like another person with a pair of glasses or something.
So each one would stand up, take the bullfight, the same bullfight, to a different point and add a detail.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh my God.
In other words, it would take them maybe 45 minutes to say, do you remember the time when we were at the bullfight and this woman did such and such?
Wow.
It was like drawing a picture.
Well, let me ask you a pull-it-all-together question. I was about to think that what a language is a great connector, but this last story makes me wonder. These are five men really sharing and connecting on details. So is the difference that language makes just efficiency, or does it affect your heart or your whole way of... I can't tell. I'm not sure anymore.
Well, I'll give you Ildefonso's answer, which when I saw him a couple years later after this incident, I asked him about his friends, and he said he couldn't talk to them anymore. He wasn't willing to go through that tedious effort of all the miming anymore. But the interesting thing that he said was he can't even think that way anymore. He said he can't think the way he used to think. And when I pushed him to ask about what it was like to be languageless, the closest he ever came to any kind of an answer was exactly that. I don't know. I don't remember. I think differently now.
Susan Schaller is author of the book A Man Without Words. Go to radiolab.org for more info. And if you go there, or if you're subscribed to our podcast, you'll get this automatically. But there's a beautiful short film directed by two really talented guys, Will Hoffman and Daniel Mercadante, that is all about words.
Message 7.
Hi, this is Anne Sanghas, just back from Nicaragua, just in time to read in the credits. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad and Pat Walters. Our staff includes Ellen Horn,
Soren Wheeler,
Rena Farrell,
Lulu Miller,
Tim Howard,
and Lynn Levy.
With help from Sharon Chaddock, Raymond
Gungakar, Nicole Corey,
and Sam Rowden.
Special thanks to Posey Gruner.
Bye-bye.
End of message.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.